Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Yeah, I just want to mention that after the Savasava Sutta, I won't take, at this point, Majjhima Nikaya number 66, that the one called Lakutika Kokkuma Sutta. But we'll take that at a later point. It seems that one has to prepare for that with other suttas to pave the way for that. I think it's premature to take that right now. So after the Savasava Sutta, then we will go into the... And again, I don't know if I mentioned this, but I'm not going to do the analysis of the path factors. That is what I had listed originally, Samyutta 45, number 8, because I did that in the Saturday lecture. So then I would just be pretty much repeating on Tuesday what I've already done on Saturday. But we'll go directly into Majjhima Nikaya number 117. This is the Maha Chattarisaka Sutta. Okay, so now we will continue with Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 2, the Savasava Sutta. And in the last class, I had finished, gone through paragraph number 8, which explained how, just to review, this whole sequence explains how the untaught ordinary person, or what I would now call the uninstructed worldling, does not understand the things fit for attention, those things that are unfit for attention, and so he attends to those things that are unfit for attention, and does not attend to those things fit for attention. As a result, the asavas arise in him, and the arisen asavas become stronger. Then, in paragraph number 7, he attends unwisely to the past, the future, and the present. In paragraph number 8, he grabs hold of one of these 6 views. As a result of grasping hold of one of these 6 views, he becomes fettered by the fetter of views, and so the untaught ordinary person is not free from birth, aging, and death, not free from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. He is not freed from suffering. Okay, and now we come to the opposite side of the presentation. This is the side that is concerned with the development of what is here called the well-taught noble disciple. I would now translate this, the instructed noble disciple. Many people, not many, but some commentators, writers on Buddhism think that what the phrase instructed noble disciple means a disciple who is a noble person, an Arya Pugala. And I used to think the same way. But now, looking at the way the phrase is used over and over in the text, it seems to me that it doesn't quite have that sense. But rather, Arya Savaka means a disciple of the Noble One. So this is a disciple who is instructed, learned, who knows the teaching, a disciple of the Noble One, particularly the chief Noble One is the Buddha, but also it includes all the other Noble Ones, like the other Noble Disciples of the Buddha. And so this is a disciple who has received instructions from the Buddha or from other Noble Disciples, and who is practicing correctly for the attainment of the noble status. In some places, the phrase instructed noble disciple is clearly pointing to one who has reached one of the stages of noble realization. But the way it's generally used, it seems to me that it's just pointing to a disciple who is practicing correctly in accordance with the instructions of the Buddha. And so this is described as a disciple who has regard for the Noble One, who has literally, the Pali expression means, who is a seer of the Noble One. And he is said to be skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma. This means, by saying that he's skilled in their Dhamma, it means that he has the theoretical knowledge of the teaching. And to say that he's disciplined or trained in their Dhamma, this means that he has practical training in the teaching. He is Arya Dhammasa Kovido, skilled or experienced in the Dhamma, the doctrine of the Noble One. Arya Dhamme Suvinito, well trained, well disciplined in the Noble Dhamma, or the Dhamma of the Noble One, who has regard for the Sapurisa. This is the superior person. Again, this will be the Buddha and the Buddha's noble disciples. And he's skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma. And this disciple will understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. And since that is so, he does not attend to those things unfit for attention, and he attends to those things fit for attention. Okay, then paragraph 10 goes on. What are the things unfit for attention that he does not attend to? These are the things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire arises in him, and the arisen taint of ignorance increases. Those are the things unfit for attention that he does not attend to. And what are the things fit for attention that he attends to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire does not arise in him, and so on for the other taints, and the arisen taint of ignorance is abandoned. These are the things fit for attention that he attends to. By not attending to things unfit for attention, and by attending to things fit for attention, the unarisen taints do not arise in him, and the arisen taints are abandoned. Okay, last time I drew on the, or I wrote on the board, a correlation between certain ways of attending to things and the taints or offices that are likely to arise through those wrong ways of attention. I'll just repeat this. Okay, I tried to connect the arising of the asavas with certain special objects, which you call the focal points for the arising of these asavas. Those are the things that one attends to. And then the way one attends to them is through these distortions. In Pali, the technical term is vipalasa. You call them distortions or inversions of perception. Okay, so when one perceives and then thinks, reflects upon things through these distortions or inversions, then this serves as a strong basis for the arising of unarisen asavas and for strengthening the asavas that have already arisen. And the special strong causes that I mentioned, okay, for the arising of the asava of sensual desire, there are the five, they're called the five cords or objects of sensual pleasure. Beautiful and delightful forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations. And so when one perceives these as being especially attractive and beautiful, or when one perceives these as being especially pleasurable sources of true happiness, that acts to stimulate the arising of unarisen sensual desire and will reinforce, strengthen sensual desire that has already arisen. Then, of course, there's a natural clinging to existence which occurs in everybody. But when one starts to, those who believe in future lives or a life after death, and then they think that of some other plane of existence, some other realm, maybe some heavenly realm or some divine realm, and think that will be permanent, everlasting, and eternal. I want to be reborn or live into, go to that realm after death so I could live there for all eternity. Then there comes this clinging to existence directed to that realm, that strong yearning for continued existence in that realm. That becomes a strong, these such thoughts become a strong basis for the, and then one is perceiving that realm of existence through the distortion of permanence. One takes it to be permanent and eternal. So this becomes a basis for the arising of the unarisen asava of this desire for existence. And if there is a desire for existence already arisen, such thoughts, such perceptions will strengthen that asava. And then people who are skilled in samadhi meditation achieve experiences of jhana or deep samadhi, and they take this to be an eternal bliss, to be a revelation of some kind of divine essence dwelling within. And they hold maybe that when one dies, then the body will perish, but this true essence, this blissful, eternal nature, that will remain the same forever. And so here we could see the clinging to existence, the craving for existence, is grasping on to these blissful experiences or these very tranquil experiences in meditation. And then it's that clinging to these experiences that is the activation of the bhava-sattva, the taint of craving for existence, desire for existence, and that brings about the continuation of existence. Then all phenomena, all the constituents of existence, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, as well as all external phenomena, can be perceived through the distortion of taking them to be I and mine. These spontaneous thoughts of I and mine arise. That is, in a sense, the distortion of taking what is not self to be self. And these thoughts, these ideas, these notions of I and mine, this is the fuel, so to speak, for the arising of unarisen ignorance and for strengthening arisen ignorance. Actually, ignorance runs through all three of, ignorance runs through the other two asavas as well, since without ignorance, there cannot be the taint of sensual desire, there cannot be the taint of craving for existence. But I would say that the strong, special, specific, strong condition for the arising of ignorance and for the continuation of ignorance are these deluded notions of I and mine. So I collected a number of other suttas from Samyutta Nikaya, in which the Buddha speaks, the Buddha or sometimes the disciples speak about what is ignorance and what is the opposite of ignorance, what is true knowledge. Sometimes ignorance is connected with the mark of permanence. Okay, one does not, what is ignorance? One does not understand physical form, the body, its arising and its vanishing. One does not understand feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, their arising and vanishing. That is ignorance. And what is true knowledge? One understands form, feeling, perception, and so on. One understands their arising. One understands their vanishing. That's Samyutta Nikaya 22.1.2.6. Then Samyutta Nikaya 22, chapter 22, number 129. What is ignorance? One does not understand the gratification, the danger or drawback, the escape in regard to the five aggregates. And so true knowledge is understanding the gratification, danger, and escape in the five aggregates. Samyutta Nikaya 22, number 131. One does not understand the origin and passing away, the gratification, danger, and escape in the five aggregates. That is ignorance. And true knowledge is understanding the origin and passing away, the gratification, danger, and escape in the five aggregates. And Samyutta Nikaya number 135, what is ignorance? One does not understand physical form, its origin, its cessation, and the way to its cessation. One does not understand feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, their origin, their cessation, and the way to their cessation. And what is true knowledge or wisdom? One understands form, its origin, its cessation, and the way to its cessation. One understands feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, their origin, their cessation, and the way to their cessation. Okay, so now the Buddha now gives, in coming back to the Sabbasatha Sutta, a very specific way in which the noble disciple will attend to things in order to overcome theosophies. And he uses the expression here, he attends wisely, he applies, he called yoniso manasikara. As I explained in the first talk, I don't really like now the translation attending wisely, but yoniso doesn't really mean wisdom, so, but rather has a sense of thoroughly, carefully, meticulously, deeply. All of those ideas are incorporated within this word yoniso. So he attends, but still, for convenience, we'll just follow the translation here. He attends wisely to this is dukkha, this is suffering. He attends wisely, this is the origin of suffering. He attends wisely, this is the cessation of suffering. He attends wisely, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And so we have the mode of attention that the noble disciple will apply, formulated in terms of the Four Noble Truths. But actually, the realization of the Four Noble Truths as such will come at what we call the peak level of development. But at the lower level, we could say that the noble disciple will begin just as these four modes of distorted attention, distorted perception, is what leads to the arising of the asapas. So the disciple, in preparing the way for this realization, the penetration of the Four Noble Truths, will start attending to things through the four, we call them the four correct ways of perception. He will observe that the five chords of sensual pleasure that people take to be pleasurable and enjoyable, when you examine them yoniso, deeply, thoroughly, carefully, are not really pleasurable. They give feelings of pleasure, they give enjoyment, that is the gratification in them. But when you look deeply below the surface, this pleasure is just transitory. It's not really gratifying or deeply satisfying, and it causes an addiction so that one is always in the grip of this need for pleasure. It causes restlessness, anxiety when one is holding on to the things that one wants to enjoy. And when one can't hold on, when one loses them, then one feels miserable. And so one sees the five chords of sensual desire, that one takes them to be pleasurable, are really dukkha. Then one contemplates the states of existence, all states of existence, with wisdom. One sees that they are impermanent. Even reflectively, one can consider that they are all bound to pass away. And as one goes on observing phenomena with the eye of insight, then one will see that even within, from one moment to the next, phenomena are arising and passing away. So they are all impermanent, even on a momentary basis. So there's nothing to be taken as permanent. And then one examines all of these phenomena, again, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, all external phenomena, using this eye of wisdom, careful attention, thorough attention, and one sees that they are cannot, because they're impermanent, one cannot take them to be a true I, a true mind, a true self. But whatever is impermanent is non-self. Okay, and so as the disciple is applying this contemplation of things through this, you call them the four corrected modes of observation, then he is developing the actual wise attention to the characteristic of dukkha, the mark of dukkha, to the first noble truth. And as he investigates, sees where does this dukkha originate from, and through actual experience, one will see that whatever suffering arises first at the experiential level, experience, suffering, misery, anxiety, grief, lamentation, worry, dejection, despair, all come from craving and clinging. So one understands the origin of suffering. Then as insight deepens, one will be able to see how this craving and clinging is conditioned by ignorance. This ignorance has to be conditioned by the craving and clinging from a previous life that brought one into this one. And through a kind of reflective contemplation, one could come to see the beginninglessness of this process of defilements bringing new existence serving as the breeding ground for fresh defilements breeding new existence. Then, as one goes on contemplating through the three characteristics, at a certain point one will reach the noble path whereby one penetrates the truth of the cessation of suffering. That is Nibbana as the ultimate, the unconditioned, the end of suffering. And then one now knows through direct experience that one has practiced this way, developing this Noble Eightfold Path, and one has reached the experience of the cessation of suffering. And so one knows that this Noble Eightfold Path is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. In fact, this is an interesting parallel. Just on Saturday, I was explaining the development of the right mindfulness through the practice of the Dhammanupassana. And we saw that the practice of Dhammanupassana, that's the contemplation of phenomena, it reaches its culmination in what? Understanding this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And so this, just as the practice of right mindfulness culminates what we might call the mindful contemplation of the Four Noble Truths, so here the wise attention, or thorough attention, careful attention, practiced by the noble disciple also culminates in the wise attention to the Four Noble Truths. And so this realization, this first initial thorough realization of all Four Noble Truths simultaneously, this marks the attainment of the first level of awakening, the first level of world-transcending realization. That's called the stage of stream entry. And so the text continues, when he attends wisely in this way, or maybe as he is attending wisely in this way, three fetters are abandoned in him. Yeah, I don't like personality view. Better I go along with identity view. It's Sakkaya Ditti. What is, I'll read, then I'll explain. Sakkaya Ditti, identity view, doubt, and adherence to rules and observances. Sila Bhatta Paramartha. Then these are called the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. Okay, now what is called identity view or personality view? This is the view of a truly existing self, of a true self existing in relation to the five aggregates. And now we have five aggregates. What are they? My memory is getting bad. Old age.
Can I erase this?
Can somebody tell me all five of them in correct order? If you could do it in Pali. Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Say it in English also. Good. Excellent. Since it's not the Pali class, I won't put the Pali on. That actually doesn't hurt. Actually, you should know the Pali also. So I'll write the Pali. Okay, but for English, we have rupa or physical form, bodily form. Then vedana, that's feeling, not as emotions, but the feelings of pleasure, of pleasant feelings, painful feelings, and neutral feelings. Perception, that's the function, the mental function, which notes the qualities, characteristics of the object. Then the volitional formation is basically what we would call an umbrella category for including just about all mental functions that don't fall into the other aggregates, but the main component of this is volition, which in Pali, what is the Pali word for volition? No. Chetana. And then vijnana is consciousness, which you might take as the basic awareness of an object, that which underlies all cognition, which makes cognition possible. So all of the others are functioning together with this consciousness to cognize an object. So that all of the other mental functions are functioning together with consciousness to cognize an object. Okay, now what occurs within the experience of an ordinary person, one who doesn't have insight into the Dhamma, understanding of the Dhamma, we have this idea of I that arises naturally, spontaneously, through our own innate ignorance. And so what we do is we take this idea of I to be something genuine that points to a genuine self. But we take this idea of I to be genuine, and then we try to give some content to this idea of I by formulating a relationship between the idea of I and the five aggregates. And so when one takes the idea of I as being something genuine, authentic, real, that is what is meant by self. It is taking this notion of I to be an indicator of something real, some real entity. And then once one takes that idea of I to be indicative, to indicate a real entity, one has to figure out the relationship between that I, the truly existing I, which is now taken to be myself, and the five aggregates. And so when we go about thinking about this, reflecting upon it, in relation to any aggregate, there are four ways one can go about this. One way is to identify this apparent self, or this idea of self, with the aggregate. One thinks, this aggregate is the self. I am form, the body. Or I am feeling. I am perception. I am volitional formation. I am consciousness. Okay, so the first A here stands for any of the aggregates, whichever aggregate one chooses. So the first is one takes the aggregate to be oneself. Great identification. In the second, one doesn't identify the aggregate with the self, but rather here the self seems to be something separate from the aggregate. And one tries to, well, to posit a relationship between the self and the aggregate based upon this idea of separateness. And so the second position is that the self is the owner of the aggregate. The self possesses the aggregate. In the third position, one regards the self usually as something vast, maybe something infinite, boundless, and the aggregate as something existing within the self. Here the self is like a container, and the aggregates are like the contents of that container. Okay, in the fourth position, one conceives of the self to be something, say, dwelling within. Maybe the self is something minute, very small, or something deep within, and the aggregates are the container of the self. This is sometimes the analogy is used of you have the casket, and then inside the casket is the precious gem, the jewel. And so they say that inside this substance, this corrupted substance of mind and matter, when you look deep within, you find the true, pure, eternal self. So this is the fourth position. And then you can take these positions, four positions, and elaborate upon them in relation to any of the five aggregates, to all of the five aggregates. So in this way, one gets 20 varieties of identity view. And if you look through the whole history of philosophy, you find different examples of these types of views. But they're not only philosophical views, but they're also views that arise in ordinary people. You ask any person, what is yourself? Many people nowadays are materialists. They will just say, ah, I am just the body. They don't believe in any kind of spirit or soul. But then you ask good church-going theists, and they will say, well, I have this body and the mind, but inside there is the eternal soul. That is myself. Yeah. Well, I think one could put it that way, so that perhaps the views are not necessarily mutually exclusive, but I think when the four types of four positions are formulated, they're done so just to include all possible ways in which the view of self might be formulated, even though, as I said, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. But does anybody else have any idea on this? Do you have any idea? Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, all of the implications are not spelled out in the text, so it's something that we just have to use reflection to try to work out for ourselves. You had the question? Sometimes in the text, the Buddha does formulate the doctrine of anatta in order to show, in a way that shows that the absence of this control or mastery over the aggregate. He says, for example, in the, it's called the Discourse on the Characteristic of Non-Self, that if form or feeling or any of the aggregates was self, then we would be able to direct it, to control it in such a way that we could say, let my body be thus, let my body not be thus. And just by commanding it, it would conform to our, it would conform to our command. But since we don't have this control, therefore the body, feeling, perception, and so on, is not self, or not the property of the self. Any further questions? Okay, so the first fetter that he's abandoned is this 20 types of identity view. Then there's the fetter of doubt. And the usual way to understand this is doubt now about the Buddha, because now he's seen the truth of the Buddha's teaching, so he knows that the Buddha is the enlightened one. He has no more doubt about the Dhamma, since he's seen the truth of the Dhamma, so he knows that the Dhamma is the truth. He has no more truth about the Aryan Sangha, since this is a community of noble ones, since he knows that there are others who have seen this truth of the Dhamma. And he has no more truth about the training, he has no more doubt about the training, since he has followed the training and seen the truth through by following that training. So he's overcome that doubt. But one might also understand the overcoming of doubt is the removal of this 16-fold doubt that's elaborated in paragraph 7. And then the third fetter, adherence to rules and observances. Don't think that it means that give up the precepts and go out and do what you want. In fact, maybe adherence to rules, not such a good rendering, but it's rather, and I think this is formulated against the background, the Indian background of the Buddha's time, where the Brahmins had their sets of Vedic prescriptions. The rules laid down in the Vedas, you have to perform these rituals, these sanskaras, these particular, you know, these rituals, these ceremonies, in order to purify oneself. And by doing so, if one undergoes these rituals and ceremonies of purification, one's sins, one's negative karma get burned away. And in the other camp, the camp of the ascetics, there were those who believed that by undertaking these extremely grueling, extremely severe practices of self-mortification, one could burn up one's defilements and gain liberation. One undertakes such practices as fasting for long periods, taking only small quantity of food, just enough to survive on, exposing one's body to the heat of the sun, the cold of the winter, bathing in ice-cold water, sleeping on thorns, beds of thorns, and so on. And so these are called, and then one makes vows to observe these practices. One doesn't just observe them, but one makes vows to observe them. And some of the ascetics, they would stand on one, even now they're standing on one foot for long periods. Some go out naked, or they wear very rough garments. Even the Buddha undertook these practices, you find them described, especially in the Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta number 12, the Greater Discourse on the Lion's Roar, Sutta number 30, we did this last year, number 36, the Greater Discourse of Satchika. The Buddha undertook many of these practices. And so the undertaking these practices in the belief that this is the way to purification, this is the way to enlightenment, this is the way to true realization, that is what's meant by adhering or grasping, wrong grasp of rules and observances. And then comes this concluding statement. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. And it's a little puzzling statement because the expression taints or asavas usually has a very specific reference. Kamasava, the taint of sensuality, bhavasava, the taint of craving for existence, avijasava, the taint of ignorance. And so, personality view, doubt, adherence to rules and observances. In the text, those aren't categorized as asavas. What to do? The commentary has a pretty elaborate way to explain this, which I have to say, to me, seems contrived, like they don't really understand it either, but they use an elaborate way of explanation or justification, bringing in first in the Abhidhamma one has ditti also included as an asava. Are there any suttas which mention ditti asava? Yeah, and that sort of could be a late modification. But it comes in the Abhidhamma enumeration of the asavas. They include ditti, the taint of views, of wrong views. And so then the commentary can say that identity view and adherence to rules and observances, those are included under the asava of views, and then doubt gets aligned with the asava of ignorance. So otherwise I don't quite know how to handle this. I confess my own taint of ignorance. Yeah, Peter. Yeah. So seeing, okay, that's a good question. The word for seeing is dasana, dasana, which means literally seeing, by view, by vision, or by vision, by seeing. And that is said because, okay, through attending wisely, when that wise or thorough attention reaches its culmination, one attains that first experience of, we call the first stage of enlightenment, the first stage of awakening, which is the seeing. What's distinctive of that first stage is the first seeing, thorough seeing of all four noble truths. Or it can also be explained as it's the first seeing of Nibbana, the first seeing of the unconditioned element. Up to the stage, one will be contemplating with insight the five aggregates as impermanent, bound up with suffering as non-self, and so one will have a kind of insight knowledge of the first noble truth. One will have a kind of inferential understanding that this suffering originates from craving, or that dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness, originates from craving. And one will also have a kind of inferential understanding that when craving is eliminated, suffering will cease. and will also have some confidence that by following this Noble Eightfold Path, one will overcome dukkha, one will eliminate the cause of dukkha and reach the cessation of dukkha. But all of this is, at that point, it's still a matter of trust, confidence, and some degree of insight into the first noble truth, but the rest is trust and confidence. But it's when one takes the practice up to the point of the attainment of stream entry. In the text, that phrase, that stage is also described as the arising of the Dhamma Chakku, the eye of Dhamma. So it's that eye of Dhamma is what sees into the truth, the ultimate truth of the teaching. And so that's why it's called the attainment of seeing, the experience of dasana, of seeing. And when one sees that truth of the teaching, then simultaneously these fetters are abandoned. And since these fetters seem to be called taint, maybe that's the answer. Just they're called taints in a derivative way or a somewhat metaphorical way. They're not taints in the same sense in which sensuality, the craving for existence, and ignorance are taints. Maybe it's a somewhat loose application of the expression asava. No. Those taints, for the stream entry, those taints will still arise. It's just, those taints are not abandoned by seeing. The taint of sensual desire, taint of craving for existence, the taint of ignorance, are not eliminated by the attainment of stream entry. It won't, can't refer to them, but what can be said is that sensuality, craving for existence, ignorance, which might cause an eighth existence, are eliminated. Because for the stream enterer, there will be at most seven more existences, within seven more lives within samsara. And then comes the attainment of full liberation, the final nibbana. I've made a table or graph of the relation between the taints and the fetters. Should I try to put that on? Should I take this off?
These are the underlying conditions. Near the back, too. Really?
That's intentional. I have the same number for it. They're both one. Okay, the ten fetters. I see it. The writing is slanty. Okay, but identity view as a fetter is a mode of the anusya. A fetter is something. Okay, I've used English and then Pali. Okay, a fetter sangyoja, being inconsistent. A fetter is something which binds. That's obvious. Anusya means something that usually is translated underlying tendencies, latent tendencies, dormant tendencies, things that lie dormant in the mind and that keep on cropping up into active consciousness when stimulated. And in the asavas, we know, I don't like taint anymore, but influences or influxes, things that flow into the mind from deep within. Okay, so the fetter of identity view is you say it's a type of anuttiya of view, and as an asapha, it would be an asapha of view. And I put the asapha of views in square brackets because in the sutta literature, except with that one exception of Mahaparinibbana Sutta, we don't find views included as the asaphas. But in the comment, in the Abhidhamma, it becomes admitted as a full-fledged asapha. Okay, doubt is a fetter and an anuttiya, an underlying tendency, but it's not an asapha. Okay, now, grasping or adhering to rules and observances, this is considered a view, because what's involved here is the view. What underlies that grasping is the view that by following these particular rules, usually they're these ritualistic rules, or by following these aesthetic observances, one will become purified or gain liberation. Then the fetter of sensual desire, that corresponds to the anuttiya, it's called the raga anuttiya, the latent tendency of lust. But here, the lust seems to be just sensual lust. Of course, what's called attachment to existence, that's bhava raga. So raga occurs twice. So raga alone, number three, must be kama raga, sensual lust. So it's identical with sensual desire. And that would be identical with kamasava, or you could say an expression of kamasava. Then the fetter of ill will, you could say, is a manifestation of the underlying tendency of aversion. Number four. Then desire for form, desire for the formless, rupa raga, arupa raga, both are, let's say, modes, expressions of the underlying tendency of attachment to existence or desire for existence. As an underlying tendency and also as an asava. Then you come to number eight, fetter number eight. Conceit is a fetter, and it's also, there's an underlying tendency of conceit. But there's no asava for conceit. Restlessness is a fetter, but it's not, there's no underlying tendency. There must be, but it's not included. And there's no asava of restlessness. Why certain things are fetters but not underlying tendencies? Good question. Somebody should write a thesis on this. Then ignorance is the deepest fetter, the deepest anuttiya, the deepest asava. Any questions about this? Anuttiya, that's a good question. What seems to me to be the case is that out of the anuttiyas, the underlying tendencies, a few have been picked out as those that are most fundamental in what I call sustaining the bondage to the round of existence, to samsara. So those things that actually really keep us in bondage, or that keep flowing in and sustaining our existence in samsara, are the kamasava, the desire for sensuality, for sensual enjoyment, bhavasava, the attachment to existence, desire for more existence, and ignorance. Just those three. But there are certain other tendencies that are very deep-rooted, and that one has to deal with, and so the Buddha has included them as underlying tendencies, like views, doubt, aversion, that is the synonym for ill will, conceit, So these are not as fundamental as theosophers. That's my interpretation. But still, they're deep enough and important enough to be included in the new theory. Do you have any ideas about this? Sample or not? Yeah. Yeah, the term asava was used by the Jains, but the Jains, he took the term asava from the Jains and gave it interpretation, but he does make it such a fundamental concept in his teaching. Like, it's not just, like, it would take some terms, like maybe the Jains would use a particular term for a liberated person like Jina, and sometimes he would refer to himself as a Jina. But here he makes, like, again and again he speaks about the experience of liberation as the mind is freed from the asapha, freed from the asapha of sensuality, freed from the asapha of desire for assistance, freed from the asapha of ignorance. And then when he describes the arhat, he's keen asapha. So it's really such an important. That could be a consideration too. Okay, I think we're going to have to stop now because we're running beyond our hour. Okay, so we will continue with the Sabhasava Sutta next week. Shall we share the merit with the Devas, the Buddhas, the other beings, and with the Nagas, asking them to protect the Buddha Sasu. Akasa ta tabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang lakantu sasanam. Akasa ta tabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang lakantu desanam. Akasa ta tabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang lakantu mantaram. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.